I hope that everyone who was hoping to get here was able to get here. Welcome to the public meeting regarding the Rennie Farm site. My name is Mike Wimsatt. I serve as director of the Waste Management Division for the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. We are very happy to be here to answer your questions and present some information about the Rennie Farm site. I'm going to serve as moderator for this evening's meeting. And I want to start out by saying they're not here now, but there may be a cable access television personnel coming to videotape this for cable access television. So I just want to make everyone aware of that. If you're uncomfortable with that, please seek out someone from the agency or from Dartmouth to let them know that. But that they're not here now, but they may be coming in a little bit. So I want to start out by saying that we are going to be... Maybe we aren't. I apologize. This doesn't seem to be advancing.
Page up, page down.
Well, while he's working on that, every good meeting starts with an AV problem. I would like to introduce the folks who are going to be speaking tonight. What we're going to do is have a presentation from a number of people from the Department of Health and Human Services, from DES, and from the consultants for Dartmouth College who have been doing the work on the site. And I want to introduce those folks to you. We're going to have some introductory remarks from our Commissioner Tom Burak, from Rick Mills, an Executive Vice President with Dartmouth, and then we're going to go right into a program designed to try to bring everyone up to speed on the work that's been done at the site and that we're anticipating having done. And then once we've done that, we'll try to limit questions. I'd rather not have questions during that because I want to be respectful of people's time. I want to make sure that we get through the program promptly, and then what we really want to do is open it up to all of you to express your concerns and ask any questions you might have, and we're going to do our very best to answer those questions tonight. So with that, I want to introduce Dr. Twyla Kenna, who's, I don't know if you could stand up, Twyla, who is with our Department of Health and Human Services Radiological Health Program, and she's going to be talking about that program's activities surrounding this site and the work that they do. Next to her is Paul Rydell, who is our project manager for the site, and he's going to be presenting on the work that DES is doing to oversee and direct the work at the site. Later on, or following that, we're going to have Charles Watts, if you could stand up, Charles, who's with CLIM Environmental. He's a consultant to Dartmouth College who's done work primarily on the radiological portion of this site. And then following him will be James Week, who was with GZAGU Environmental, and he will be presenting on GZA's work at the site, both past and future planned work. So with that, what I'd like to do is introduce, and I guess we're good, we're back online here. I want to introduce Dr. Twyla Kenna, or I'm sorry, no I don't. I want to introduce our Commissioner Tom Burak, who's going to make some introductory remarks on behalf of the Department of Environmental Services.
Thank you, Mike. Good evening, everyone, and welcome, and thank you for being here. I just want to start by acknowledging that this is not a situation that anyone wanted. Having said that, we're all here because this is an issue that is important to all of us. And importantly, we at DES are here and involved because we want to ensure, it's really our duty to ensure, that necessary measures are taken by the responsible party to protect public health and the environment under the applicable laws and regulations. The neighbors, folks in the community, are understandably concerned and looking for a deeper understanding of the situation. Members of the community asked us at DES if we could hold a public meeting, and we are here tonight to honor that request. And we are really here to ensure that we have good communications occurring and continuing so that we can ensure that information is exchanged. By way of very quick background, We've required extensive sampling of water supplies across a wide area, and that sampling did detect contamination in one private drinking water well, and the home affected has been provided with a point of entry treatment system. To date, we have not detected 1,4-dioxane in any other drinking water wells. We are continuing to require periodic monitoring off-site. With respect to this evening's program, you can see the outline here of what we're going to hear, but what's important to understand is what our goals are. We first want to ensure that we share updates on the work that's been conducted to date and the next steps that are planned. We want to hear your questions and concerns, and we want to the best of our ability, answer your questions and address your concerns. But I would ask you to please understand that it's possible that some of your questions are ones that we will not be able to answer tonight, either because we simply don't have the information necessary or perhaps we don't have the right expertise available this evening. But we will identify any of those outstanding questions and we will ensure that we get back to everyone promptly with follow-up responses. And finally, our goal is to firmly establish lines of communication for the future going forward with respect to issues at the site, so that coming out of this evening, everyone will know the people they can contact if they have further questions or concerns. And with that, I will turn things back over to Mike, and again, thank you very much for being here this evening.
Thank you, Commissioner. Next, I'd like to introduce Executive Vice President Rick Mills of Dartmouth College for some introductory remarks on behalf of the college.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you to the state officials who are here tonight and convene this meeting. And thanks to all of you as our neighbors, both neighbors of Rennie Farm and neighbors in the greater Hanover area, for coming tonight. I'd like to do a couple things. First, I'd like to introduce the Dartmouth team that's working on the Rennie Farm, starting with Steve Moore, who is reporting to me as Vice President for Institutional Projects, Maureen O'Leary and Mike Simmons out of Environmental Health and Safety at Dartmouth, and Ellen Arnold out of the Real Estate at Dartmouth, who's in the back. I think most important, and to start out, I want to apologize on behalf of Dartmouth. There are legal standards, there are scientific standards. We'll meet those standards, we'll comply with them, but there's another standard that's important here, and it's the standard of being a good neighbor. And Dartmouth, for what's happened in the past, we haven't been a good neighbor. And it took time to reveal that we haven't been a good neighbor, but I'm here as a representative of Dartmouth to tell you we know we haven't been a good neighbor, and that's going to guide our actions going forward. We want to be a good neighbor. We want to do the things that we need to do to be a good neighbor, to deal with a problem that dates back to the 60s but is with us today, and we're the institutional leaders who are here today, and I want to commit to you on our behalf that we're taking it seriously. We're going to meet all of the legal standards, we'll meet all of the scientific standards, but more than that, we want to live up to a standard of being a good neighbor. And good neighbors don't always agree with each other, they don't always see eye to eye, but they treat each other with respect, and they treat the neighborhood with respect. And we haven't done that in this case, but we're working to get there, and we intend to do it. And being transparent, sharing information with you, making forums like this available in conjunction with the state, holding office hours at the site, that's part of the steps to try to be a better neighbor. And we know there's more work. There's remediation work that needs to happen. There's mitigation of damages that may flow from this. We need to do all of that. We're still early in a process that's likely to take some time. As the scientists give us more information about what's there, as you understand more of what's happening, there's going to be more we need to do. We're in the very, very early part of a process that will evolve over the next months and possibly a year. But during that time, we're committed to doing the right thing. We haven't in the past. That's what led to this problem. It wasn't in the 60s and 70s. Nobody seemed to think it was a bad idea. Time has shown it was a really bad idea. And we're going to try to make that right. So on behalf of Dartmouth, thanks to all of you for coming. I'm really sorry you're here as neighbors because of what we did, but we'll work on this. And you can always reach members of the Dartmouth team or me, and thank you.
Thank you. And with that, I would like to turn the podium over to Dr. Twyla Kenna from our New Hampshire Department of Health and Human Services. And Dr. Ken is going to provide an overview of the Department of Health and Human Services' role in the investigation cleanup of the Rennie Farm site.
Hello, my name is Twyla Kenna. I'm the manager of the Radioactive Materials Program, and I'll be covering the regulatory role of radiological health. Another member of our staff is also here tonight. She's in the front row, Tina Laramie. This slide shows the mission statement for radiological health. We carry out our mission statement through effective regulation, licensing, inspection, enforcement, and emergency response. Section can be broken down into three programs. We have radiological emergency response program. This involves participation in exercises and drills for the nuclear power plant, Seabrook, and also requires response for VY and also for Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. The radiation machine program registers over 4,400 machines in the medical, dental, veterinary, chiropractic, podiatry, and industrial sites across the state. Radioactive material has 83 licenses and responds to approximately 12 incidents a year. These incidents involve radioactive material that's found in the public area. Oftentimes, this is medical waste from patients or old military equipment. We isolate, identify, and assist in safe deposit of this radioactive material that comes to light. This slide shows the legal basis for the radiological health section. An agreement state means that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has relinquished its authority over the control of radioactive material in the state of New Hampshire, except for federal sites and nuclear power plants. At present, there are 37 agreement states in the country. New Hampshire, the radiological health section, does not perform the cleanup at these sites. What we do is we oversee the actions of the licensees and the contractors. We review the programs that they set up and they give to us, and we compare them to federal technical specifications, et cetera, to give approval when they pass the requirements that are needed for this. And then we oversee the actual work and approve the final results to make sure they still meet the qualifications needed for whatever release requirements are necessary. The timeline for Rennie Farm basically started in 2011, even though monitoring wells, et cetera, were there. But as far as radiological health, that's when the health and safety plan was submitted to us for our review and approval. This means that we reviewed it and compared it to the types of federal requirements that were necessary to have this work done. After the approval, the work was completed as necessary. In 2012, there was a request for soil disposition. We had to, again, look over the results and all the analytical results that were given to us, and we reviewed those. And once those passed the tests that were needed, we could then let them dispose of that material. In 2014, we had the final report for this remediation project that was done. It was submitted for our review, and again, we went through all of the documents, and on that documentation that was provided, it was released for unrestricted use. And then, as everybody knows, in 2016, we had more information that came to site. And once this new information was known that there was more problems or more information that needed to be gathered on the site, we were supplied with a work plan was presented to us to continue this type of work and completely remediate the site. We went through, I'd say in June was the survey which showed that there was this information that needed to be done. In August, we were given the work plan that was approved and excavation occurred. And now we're waiting for the final report to be submitted, and then we'll know at what level we can release this site. And this site shows the contact information we have for the state in case you want to get in touch with us in any town.
Thank you, Dr. Kenna. Next, I'd like to introduce Paul Rydell, the project manager for the Rennie Farm site for New Hampshire DES. Paul is going to provide an overview of the department's role in the investigation and cleanup of the site. Paul?
Thanks, Mike. As advertised, I'm Paul Rydell, and I have been the DES's project manager for environmental service for investigation and cleanup of the site. Comes to us following the discovery of chemical waste as part of that late 2011 removal that Twyla talked about. And it's in our program, hazardous waste remediation, which is basically just, in our terminology, essentially just means it's non-petroleum. We apply the same process to petroleum release sites, release of other solvents, other wastes, but it's a different program. These types of non-petroleum sites fall to us in the Hazardous Waste Remediation Bureau for investigation and cleanup. And I just put together a quick half a dozen slides just to talk through our process of how we manage these sites. So again, what's not included is petroleum. Those are the broader population of sites that we have going through corrective actions, investigation, and cleanup in the site, in the state. This site falls down here as a what we refer to as a state lead hazardous waste site. And typically, these are a lot of chlorinated solvent release sites. Again, non-petroleum, the former dry cleaners, those kinds of sites throughout the state, as well as a couple other categories there. As you know, the main groundwater contaminant at the Rennie Farm site is 1,4-dioxane. That's what we've been investigating, chasing that plume basically to define the limits of that. We see 1,4-dioxane in groundwater at a number of these sites. Typically, with the state lead hazardous waste sites, again, if they're chlorinated solvents, often we have 1,4-dioxane along as a mixed contaminant with those types of release sites. As well as, broadly speaking, perhaps a third or so of the online landfills, all of which have been closed out now at this point. But if they accepted industrial waste, solvent-related waste, often we have 1,4-dioxane in a mixed plume with those types of sites as well. Our framework for investigation, management, and overall cleanup of these sites is under the contaminated site management rules. The major tenets or the major process steps there are investigations to understand the nature of the source. You know, is this simply a spill to soils such that the remedy could be removal to shallow soils? Is it release of denser chlorinated solvents where we might have a deeper groundwater problem that would require a more sophisticated remedy? As part of those investigations, we need to define the extent of the contaminant plume in groundwater. So basically the source is feeding that. How far is that plume gone? And the main objective there is to identify and protect receptors, whether that's a water well or volatilization of vapors to breathing space in a building, those kinds of issues. From those studies, there's a source control remedy that's evaluated, proposed. We review all that and approve that, and then as part of the implementation of the remedy, there's post-closure, post-remedy monitoring and reporting just to confirm that, you know, conditions remain as expected and the remedies protective and performing as expected. So just to put a few more points behind that last slide, if you went to the rules and looked at the major process steps, these are basically the submittals or the titles of the major project documents. If you spend any time on our one-stop website, you know there's a number of prior hydrogeologic investigations there. That's generally the first step in the process. So again, here's where you're putting in monitoring wells, collecting soil and groundwater samples. That's often iterative because it builds on the data you may learn from a prior step, and that informs the scope of subsequent investigations. Again, the target there is to understand the source, the extent of the plume in groundwater, and then that leads to what's proposed as a remedy, which is the Remedial Action Plan, or RAP. And close behind that is a groundwater management permit. We issue the permit. That accomplishes a couple of things. It formally defines a legally enforceable program of ongoing monitoring, and it also defines a groundwater management zone. That's that GMZ, which is a legally defined surveyed feature that encloses the plume and includes restrictions on groundwater use, requires groundwater treatment if there's drinking water wells in that GMZ, and basically establishes that to be protective of future groundwater use in the area. Just try to go quick here. Down the road, we do require a RAP implementation report, and this is really just for the project record. That's all the gory details of what's actually been built and put in the ground. So that would be as-built plans and all those kinds of engineering drawings to just document what's done for the project record. So that's sort of the process, I guess, in abstract, or just talking off of the rules. How has that been applied to date at Rennie Farm? Well, right now, the hydrogeologic investigations, and there's been several iterations there, as you probably know, that's nearly complete. They're still drilling, as we speak, on some of the more distant wells, to refine the extent of the plume and understand how far that's gone. The remedial action plan, or RAP, was just submitted on September 2nd or thereabouts. That's currently being reviewed by us. And as part of the RAP, there is a proposed groundwater management zone. It's included in there. Again, it's somewhat conceptual because we still have new monitoring wells going in to refine that picture, but basically included just to make the RAP as comprehensive as it could be at this time. My last real slide of substance, just to clarify responsibilities, the responsible party, the site owner at all these release sites, like Rennie Farm, where chemicals have been released and impacted soil and groundwater quality, is always remains with the site owner, basically. So in this instance, Dartmouth College, they're responsible for retaining a consultant to do the work. They basically go out and do the field investigations, review things in concert with us. We would review their work plans, develop scopes of what they're doing, review their reports, et cetera. And then on down the line, for the more complicated sites, you'll see, specialty subcontractors involved, geophysics, well drillers, et cetera. We also do recover our costs, so our labor costs for management of the site, review of documents and all that does get billed to the responsible party, to Dartmouth, as it would any other state lead has this waste site. And then finally, just as similar to what Twyla had, just a contact slide. I know I've spoken with many of you over the last few months, but even after tonight, if there's remaining questions or you need additional information, my contact information is there.
Thank you, Paul. Next, I would like to introduce Charles Watts. He's with CLIM Environmental, and Charles is going to speak about the work that CLIM has done out there with respect to investigation of the site. Charles?
Thank you, sir. Let's see if we get a presentation.
Harder.
Well, wait a minute.
No, that's not it. Okay. You can't do the end. Just this one.
Thank you for your patience. I think we've got it figured out now. Good evening, everyone. My name is Charles Watts. I'm with CLIM Environmental, and I was a project manager for the radiological work that's been done at the Rennie Farm site. I've been asked to give a very brief overview of what we have done to date to set the table for our discussion later this evening. So I've just got a few slides I'd like to share with you to give you some of the salient points of what we've been able to do to date. As the folks who spoke before me have mentioned, we've taken an iterative process, and we have gone through a number of phases in this project to try to get the work done that we need to get done. But long before we started putting shovels in the ground, we began doing research. So this process has been going on for multiple years. That process began with planning and research. One of the first steps that we undertook was to do a records review. So we looked at the records that the college had stored historically, and we looked at the records that were available at the state, and we tried to learn a little bit about the site. We were able to learn some things that we think were important. First, we learned that the site was used to dispose of radioactive animal carcasses. We learned that the site was active from the 1960s until the 1970s. We learned that there were 43 distinct burials that took place during that time, and that each of the burials had a distinct and specific plot. And we also learned that there was an inventory that detailed that there were long-lived and short-lived radioactive materials which were deposited at the site. By short-lived, we mean radioactive materials which we think would no longer be radioactive and would have decayed to background levels. By long-lived, we mean radioactive materials that would still exhibit the characteristics of radioactivity today. With that information in hand, we began planning. We met with state officials and talked about different opportunities for us to remediate the site. We developed a work plan. That work plan led to our phase one operations, which was characterized largely by the initial excavation and by the removal of the waste at the site. That led to phase two, which was additional sampling and characterization of the site, which led to final status, which was our preparation and submittal of a report detailing our actions, the survey methodologies that were employed, and the results that we had achieved. Throughout the entire process, we were involved with the state regulator. Our regulator from the radiological standpoint was Dr. Kenna's group, the radiological health section. And our team was comprised of the folks at Dartmouth College in the EHS department. We did all of our operations under the authority of the Dartmouth College Radioactive Materials License. Clem was tasked with dealing with radiological issues and subsequent waste disposal. GZA was working on chemical contaminants, and a company called InPro was brought in to operate the excavator and other heavy equipment. Phase one is when we got to the site and began actually removing the waste. We started on the western side of the burial site following the information that we had gleaned during our records review, and we began a deliberate search and recovery operation. So we were looking for waste in the actual burial site. When we found that waste, we packaged it for off-site disposal, and we worked our way through the site to bedrock from one side to the other. During this time, we encountered bags of animal waste. Those bags were black bags that were thick, perhaps 5 to 7 mils. When we opened those bags, we found that there were animal carcasses in some of them. Some of the carcasses were well preserved inside those plastic bags. We set those aside for disposal. We also found thinner bags that contained laboratory waste, plastics, glasses, and some metals. We set those aside for disposal as well. And we noticed that when we got into these plots that the waste was surrounded by compacted soil. There was the opportunity, we felt, for radioactivity to move from the bags and from the waste into the soil. So we chose to take a margin of soil around the waste at about an approximate 1 foot area and package that for disposal off-site. In order to be able to understand the different types of soil that we had at the site, we came up with a labeling system for the soil. The soil that was on top of the site that we had sampled to 1 and 2 foot depths and found no evidence of radioactivity above background, we termed green soil. And we marshaled that into an area and intended to use that soil for backfill. The soil that was within that 1 foot contiguous area around the waste items that we found at the site, we deemed to be red soil, and that was designated for disposal off-site. The remaining soil we called yellow, and the yellow soil was that soil which we sampled to try to get results to be able to support a request for release from radioactive controls for the site. Our sampling strategy was thus, we wanted to be able to focus our sampling on the yellow soil or that soil that was going to remain, and we felt that that was a conservative estimate to remove the waste in that margin of soil. We thought that would support our request for the release from radiological controls that would come later. When we got into the site, we ran into some site conditions, some that were expected, some that were not expected. Early in the process, we ran into waste layering. What we'd originally assumed that had taken place at the site was that folks who were going to do the burial would come to the site, would dig a trench, would place the waste in the site, and then would cover the trench back up. We quickly found that this wasn't the case. Rather, folks would dig a trench, they would put waste into the trench, they would cover it with a margin of soil, and then add layers of waste in soil, sometimes 4 and 5 layers deep. This waste layering greatly increased the amount of that red soil that we identified for shipment off-site and increased our ultimate disposal volume significantly. As this image shows, we also ran into a groundwater intrusion. The groundwater was present in a number of different burial plots, made excavating the material difficult, and it made visually seeing where the waste was within these plots also very difficult. As we worked our way methodically through the site, we ended up shipping a significant amount of waste. Over 19,000 pounds of animal waste was packaged and removed. Over 7,500 pounds of solid waste, like glass and metals, were packed in drums and removed. And over 17,500 cubic feet of soil was packaged and removed from the site. In all, over 90 tons of waste was repackaged and removed for off-site disposal. In the middle of our excavation, as many of you know, we ran into evidence of chemical contamination. We hit a plug of what we believe to be metal containers that contained a hazardous chemical. Operations were stopped. The college was notified, and the college notified DES. Ultimately, we were given the authority to continue with the direction of removing the contaminated soil and segregating it from our other soil designations. We moved this soil to a different area, classified it as purple soil in response to the color of the chemical that was involved, ultimately packed that soil in metal intermodal containers, which you see in the image here. After sampling that and requesting permission to dispose of this material, over 2,100 cubic feet of this purple soil was disposed off-site as well. Phase two found us in a reflective mode. We were trying to understand more about what we were able to learn from phase one. We looked at the data that we had received, and we thought that we had a couple of points that could be further expanded, so we requested permission to do additional sampling. Phase two was consisting of that sampling and the characterization that followed. That continued for a number of months. In addition to our phase two work, we also requested to move directly into final status sampling and to use any sample analysis data that we felt was valid from previous surveys in that data. We came to that conclusion that we had the information that we needed and could prepare a report that would be comprehensive in November of 2013, and we presented that to the state, which the state subsequently approved and allowed release of the site. And my colleague, Jim, is going to talk to you a little bit more about the chemical contamination that we had on site, but just for consistency, as we followed that chemical contamination, a number of different steps were taken, including the ground-penetrating radar survey, which Dr. Kenna alluded to earlier. That survey found a number of anomalies that were present at the site, specifically three anomalies. And those anomalies were each investigated, two of which turned up metal pieces that we believe to be just associated with either the fencing at the site or support operations at the site from the initial excavation. But a third anomaly upon investigation revealed that there were some bags containing laboratory and animal waste remaining at the site. With that information in hand, we prepared another work plan, submitted it to the radiological health section, and in August of this month conducted a remediation of that area. Additional waste was found, animal waste and laboratory waste was found. That material was packaged, much as we did during the initial excavation, for off-site disposal. Soil, both the red soil, the soil contiguous to the waste, and the yellow soil, the soil that remained in the excavation area, was sampled. Those samples were sent off-site for third-party analysis, and those results have since come back in. During this recent excavation, we removed approximately 250 pounds of material that we considered to be animal waste, 700 pounds, including tarps, plastics, and other things that we had found on site that constituted what we believe to be solid laboratory waste, and approximately 300 cubic feet of soil. And all these numbers of animal waste roughly equated to 2% of what we had pulled out of the ground during our initial excavation. The results that we have received from our soil sampling to date, we have preliminary results. They show no radioactivity in the samples that we had collected above background levels. We are continuing to analyze that data. As we finish our analysis, we will put that into a report and submit that report to the radiological health section for review and approval of further action. With that being said, I would like to pass the baton to my associate, Jim, who can tell you a little bit more about the chemical contamination on the site.
Good evening. I'm Jim Week, again with GZA, Geoenvironmental, and I've been GZA's project manager working on the 1,4 dioxane portion of the remediation or investigation remediation of the site. Got a nice shot there from the site, but I want to start out by just mentioning a few things about 1,4 dioxane. If you want something to visualize, you can use this here. There are four carbons, two oxygens, and a bunch of hydrogens that are there in a molecule. And It's an organic compound. It's typically a solvent, used as a solvent. In this case, we believe it was used as what's called a scintillation fluid in radiological analyses. It also does appear as a stabilizer in many solvents, as Paul Riedel mentioned, it ended up in landfills through that route. One really important property of 1,4-dioxane is that it dissolves very readily in water. It will mix in equal proportions, so referred to as miscible. So it will really like to go into the water. It has a tendency not to to attach itself to soil, so it doesn't get retarded when it's in the groundwater. It doesn't get held back. It also doesn't tend to biodegrade in the subsurface very well. And then lastly, it has very low we call volatility. Its tendency to go into the vapor phase, so it generally won't do that. All these things really result in 1,4-dioxane being really good at staying in the water and moving right along with the water, so it tends to transport rapidly compared to a lot of other contaminants. The main health concern is that it's reasonably considered to be a human carcinogen. The groundwater standard in New Hampshire is 3 micrograms per liter. And while this is not a standard, I put it on here. This is an EPA screening value that I'm aware of, that 230 micrograms per liter. It would be an acceptable level for something like showering. So what this is considered here, but basically contact with the skin. So the primary concern about this contaminant is not inhaling it or having it on your skin, but rather ingesting it, drinking the water. Going to the Rennie Farm site, this little circle here is the location. It's enclosing the location of the burial that Charles was just describing. For reference, that was Rennie Road that just came on there, and this is Hanover Center Road. And in the area, we have at the top that just came on, there's a brook called Hughes Brook. We have what we're calling an unnamed tributary to Hughes Brook, which runs right through this valley here. And there's also a southern tributary to that, which runs right along Rennie Road in this area. These become important for locations that we monitor in. And lastly, near the site, there's also a stream over on this side here. However, you can see the topography here is very, very steeply dipping off towards the east. And if you've been out to the site, you can see that the ground surface there does dip off in that direction. And the data we have to date shows everything moving in this direction. You know, we have an elevation at the site of a little over 1,000 feet. There's about 150 feet down to Rennie Road there. And then the nearest high is around 2,300 feet. I'm mentioning these things just to give you an idea of what the topography is like. You folks live there, but it helps to envision this in terms of understanding how the groundwater is going to move. Soils at the site are glacial till. They tend to have a lot of clay in them. Sometimes they're called tight. Water doesn't pass through them very readily. And the depth of rock is generally around less than 25 feet. In many cases, it's right at the ground surface. However, we are finding in some recent work that it does deepen as we go down into the valley. So the investigation that we performed, first I should mention, this is zooming in here. This is the site that just came on in green. And then we also have those same streams showing up. But you know, the hydrogeology, that is to say, the combination of the soil, rock, and how the water flows through it, it's very complex at the site. And this is largely because of the topography and because it's into the fractured rock. So it doesn't flow through the rock as it would through sand. It's going to move through individual discrete fractures. So that can make it be very challenging to find it in the subsurface and to track it. So as a result, I think as Paul Riedel had mentioned, this work has been performed in phases. It tends to be iterative. We've had a number of phases of work, and this goes back to 2012 in April when 1,4-dioxane was first detected in one of the monitoring wells that's installed right around the old burial area called GZ2. At that time, monitoring was performed of that well as well as a number of wells that were installed prior to the excavation in 2011, and a series of investigations again progressed afterward. I'm going to run through a number of the investigation tasks that we've been performing. Some of them span multiple phases of work, but one of them was to go around through the area and look at bedrock outcrops. We measure the angles of the fractures, how they, what the orientation is, so we can understand how the groundwater and the 1,4-dioxane may move within those fractures. We performed geophysical surveys. There were multiple methods that were used, including a method called VLF, very low frequency radar, to look to the extent that you can within the subsurface to look for areas where there are more fractures, because fractures are not necessarily evenly distributed within the subsurface. We've also performed surface water sampling. A number of those locations just popped up, a little hard to see on there. But there are 8 locations along this stream system that we've now are sampling. We've to date have 36 wells installed, but that number is increasing on a daily basis. And these wells, I should explain, what we do is we drill a boring down, a hole that goes into either just the soil or can go down into the fractured rock. And within that, we construct a well which is made up of PVC, and it has a small screen at one section where we're targeting as a depth to get information on the flow of water and the presence of the 1,4-dioxane to see if it's there. So these are they're not just an open hole. They're designed based on the conditions we encounter to identify it within the various units that we're trying to follow the 1,4-dioxane in. We've also sampled a number of water supply wells. Some of them just came on there in white. There are quite a few more that I'll show on another slide. But you can start to see, you know, the fairly broad coverage of sampling locations out there between the red monitoring wells and the white water supply wells. This is what the site looked like this spring with the drill rig out here. And that's the actual burial area that Charles was talking about. And this is looking at the same area from an aerial photograph. A little hard to see here. We've got one without the leaves on, so things are a little difficult to see. But this is the edge of the trees here. There's a stone wall that runs in here. Looking at this plan, you can see a number of blue rectangles. Those are the locations where, based on a sketch that was developed of the site, the animal carcasses were buried. That was located based on a number of common features that we could find on the sketch and based on an actual topographic survey or site survey that was done recently. And that gives you an idea where those are. And one of the things that Charles was talking about was this particular area where there was issues with the presence of high groundwater. And this is there's a plot here called 28. That's the plot where a lot of those conditions were noticed. I'm going to jump ahead a little bit and just explain that we have the 3 anomaly areas shown on here that Charles mentioned. This is area number 1, which is where the animal waste was recently identified. And areas 2 and 3, those were identified based on some geophysical methods, a ground-penetrating radar, and an electromagnetic method to look for metals. That work came out of some source area investigations that we were doing to try and design the remediation. We wanted to know specifically how much soil we had on site, so we were trying to develop a topographic map of the bedrock surface. So we used ground-penetrating radar to do that. In that process is when the anomalies were identified, initially with the GPR, and then we went back to try and determine whether or not they were some man-made objects and used the electromagnetic methods to do that, to look for metals. We also went back after that, once we identified those, to probe into them in June. The little green rectangles or shapes that are around the anomaly areas are the extents of the excavations that were performed in June. During that, one of the excavation area one, has been mentioned before, we did encounter some bag waste, terminated the activities at that time so that we could come back in August. And this hatched area here is the area which was excavated down to the bedrock surface in August as part of the removal that Charles was mentioning at the end of his presentation. So, again, geophysical surveys were performed in the area. We did a relatively dense groundwater sampling here. All these little red points that just came on, you can see in a grid. Those are locations where we took a sample of groundwater, just a one-time, didn't install a well, but we went down with some tooling, grabbed some water, collected samples for analysis of 1,4-dioxane. Some samples also went off for a broader suite of analyses. We've also installed additional wells within the source area. I'm just circling them there with the red circles, 11 wells. Again, kind of going through what has been done here, and I'll kind of sum that up when we get to some later slides. We've also collected soil samples for the analysis of 1,4-dioxane, as well as other contaminants. Performed the test pits that I mentioned that were done in June, and then the excavation subsequently. And lastly, in terms of the work that's been performed, here again, the topographic map with our source area here. These are the wells to date that we've sampled and have results back for. There are 36 of them. We have another 10 or so that the folks that have expressed an interest, and we're in the process of scheduling and sampling those wells. 1,4-dioxane, as been mentioned earlier, was detected at one of the locations, so one with the orange center here, at concentrations of 6.2 to 4.2 micrograms per liter, and has also been mentioned, bottled water was supplied and a treatment system was installed which treats all of the water that comes out of the well for the home. So, kind of, you know, what have we learned from all of this? And this is really summarizing a lot of information, but through all the groundwater sampling that we did in the source area, we identified this oval shape that I just turned on as being what we're calling a source area. The area has concentrations of 1,4-dioxane, which are over 500 micrograms per liter. The highest we've seen was an estimated concentration at 700 micrograms per liter. That area is consistent with the location of the purple soils that were encountered back in 2011. So that piece does fit well also. As you recall, those soils were removed. Soil sampling that we performed in the area to date has not shown high concentrations of 1,4-dioxane in the soil. As I mentioned earlier, this particular compound likes to go into the water, and it will stay in there fairly well. So what we believe at this time is that that source area represents really what we'd call a dissolved source that is slowly bleeding out of the area over time, being retarded by those properties of the soil. There may be source material there in the soil in that area, that is to say 1,4-dioxane contaminated soil. That's still a possibility, and I'll mention what we're going to do about that to evaluate it in a moment. But that's really how we understand the source to be is, again, dissolved primarily because of its properties and the data that we have to date. That source is not just in the soil, it's in the groundwater in the soil, it is also within the fractured rock. So it extends beyond the soil. And this red arrow that I just turned on really shows the direction of transport, the main axis of it. I have another slide that will show you where we believe the width of the plume to be at this time, but this generally shows how it's taking off. Now, this is very consistent with what we found the fracture orientations in the bedrock to be, in that they are generally oriented off to the northeast, and they tend to be what we call dipping very steeply, that is, as if they were pages of a book that was sitting on its edge. They're all moving, you know, all vertically oriented and off towards the north and east. So this combined with the slope that we have here results in a transport direction off towards the northeast. Looking at the larger scale here, again, transport towards the northeast, and this is that main axis that we talked about now, heading out towards the stream, which is out here. The maximum distance at which we believe we have detected it is about 1,800 feet, and that is at this location down here that's called Stream 3. It's not a third stream, it's a third sampling location on a stream, just for clarification. But and I say we believe it to be because it was a surface water sample that we collected it in. It was one time, and we detected a concentration of 0.52 micrograms per liter, well, you know, below the 3 microgram per liter, but important that it's there. We didn't see that at certain locations that we have upstream from there, that location, and it is also right along this axis of where we believe the plume to be migrating. So it does make sense that with the very low flow conditions we have in the stream right now, that we're seeing the effects of discharge to that stream. So I'm saying until we have more data from the soils in that area, we can't say for certain that that was the route that it took, but it is the most probable route. And again, we're only seeing it now because of these abnormally low flow conditions. We do have some ongoing work that's being done out here where we have detected it in bedrock trending off on that same line. So we're feeling fairly confident at this point that conceptual model, and I should explain, too, that as it leaves the source area on top of the hill, it initially would have been in the soil, but as I said, it got down into the fractured rock. From there, it migrates towards the north and east in both the soil initially and fractured rock. But then slowly, because this is what we call a recharge zone, it's a high area when it receives precipitation, it will tend to recharge the aquifer or the groundwater. We're seeing the contamination move downward into the fractured rock. Before it leaves the site, it has initially, at least based on the data we have now, is totally within the fractured rock. And then as it's approaching the stream in the center of the valley, now is reemerging into what we're finding to be a fairly thick sequence of glacial till and other sediments in there on the order of 80 feet and working its way up to the surface. This is all very brand new information that's been available and we've gotten over the past week or so from our drilling program and some recent sampling. But that's generally the model of how it's moving in the subsurface. What are we going to do about this? And this really summarizes the remedial approach that we have in the remedial action plan. One of these things, as I mentioned, was alluding to before, is sampling within the source area to look for any additional 1,4-dioxane in the soil that we could just remove simply by excavating. We're going to go into that area where we had the high concentrations and do a fairly intensive sampling program of soil, taking those soil samples off to a laboratory for analysis to determine whether or not there is actually 1,4-dioxane in the soil or whether or not this is simply a dissolved contaminant in groundwater, as mentioned before. If we do find that we have contamination in the soil that is a significant source to groundwater, that would be excavated. But one of the things we want to do before we excavate anything out there at this point is to have in place this groundwater extraction and treatment system that we've talked about. Some people call it groundwater pump and treat. And that would help us be protective of the groundwater there, and that we don't want to release anything further. We don't want to open up the subsurface, the soils, until we can have this groundwater treatment system in place, and I'll explain how that works in a moment. This would all be backed up by additional monitoring. So we'll be monitoring groundwater quality within that source area over time with the system operating. If we see evidence that there's a persistent source, we'll also look for that and remove it. Again, having the groundwater system in place will provide us some protection. And again, soil excavation, of course, as I was just mentioning. So, you know, what is the objective of the treatment pump and treatment system? This little line here, the red line that came on, this is conceptual. I'm actually hoping that we can reach out further, but this would be what we call the capture zone. So we're trying to capture all the water that's in this area and prevent it from moving downslope as the plume had been. It's quite possible it will reach out further, but this is a conservative estimate and gives you conceptually what would be happening. So in here we have these little arrows. They're all going to the little wells that are in here along these lines. Those are wells that we would install to pump water out. We'd also have a well that would be out here, and the red lines that I'm just highlighting are showing the flow from those coming to our treatment system here. This well, there's a well that would be about here along the axis of the plume to try and pull things back further. There we're going to have to do some hunting to find a good well, so we're right in one of those fractures where we see the highest amount of contamination, because it is really discreetly located in these fractures. This is just a couple shots of a similar system that the manufacturer of the system that we're going to be getting has provided to us. There are these canisters here. They would contain a material which can filter out the 1,4-dioxane. Those are regenerated using steam periodically, and then the condensate from that regeneration process would be captured and taken off-site for disposal. Once the treated water has been treated, there are two disposal locations that are subject to DES's approval that we're hoping to use. One of them would be this blue line that just lit up here, which goes out to an area near what's been referred to as the Dug Well. There's a small intermittent stream that's there that we'd use as a discharge point. Again, this is treated water, and this would be done under a permit, which is it's a EPA permit referred to as a remediation general permit. There is a significant amount of analysis that is performed associated with those on a monthly basis, typically and we expect that that we'd be doing that as well. There would also be performance monitoring of the system, too, looking at the concentrations coming in versus the concentrations going out to make sure that everything is functioning properly. In addition to that, this other area that's lighting up now with these two rectangles are showing the locations of basically like leaching fields that we want to construct. The purpose of those would be to put some of the water back into the system in the source area to flush through water that may be trapped in what we call residual pore water that would not be part of the groundwater table but trapped in there. And there can be significant amounts of mass that could be dissolved within that and suspended there. So this system would help to flush that through and accelerate the remediation. So that's basically it for the remediation. However, having said that, there's another component of this is really important, which is the long-term monitoring. And the locations you can see out here, we've got some surface water locations, but this is a monitoring location for groundwater. It consists of actually what we call a triplet, where we have three different wells installed at different depths to look at the rock and the overburden or the soil to see how the contamination is moving. These two, this one here and this one here, are in the process of being installed, and that was some, for the source of some of the data that I was alluding to earlier. There are others here in red that we will be installing as triplets. There are also wells out here which we will be installing just to provide additional assurance that we don't have contamination moving in a direction that's inconsistent with our current model, just to prove that out. And then there's some additional wells that would be installed for performance monitoring around the remedial system, which I didn't mention. We think eventually we're going to be up to over 52 wells out there. Not necessarily numbers matter, but they do give you an idea of the scope of the project and the data collection that's necessary to meet our goals. Included in the monitoring would be surface water and then also certain water supply wells. Subject to homeowners' approval, they would be reaching out to folks to ask for permission to sample on a routine basis. And that sampling would be part of the groundwater management plan that Paul Riedel referred to earlier in his presentation, which just provides the data to demonstrate that we do keep everything within that groundwater management zone that we're required to. So I think that that is about it. I'm sure there's a lot of questions, and I'll be around as late as you like to answer those. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim. Well, that brings us to the close of our formal presentations this evening. And now we get to the question and answer session. And I want to, before we start that, I just want to say a couple of things. First of all, I had intended to introduce a couple of the folks from DES who are here, and I haven't done that yet. Jim Martin, who is our public information officer, is here. And seated near him is Carly Kennison, who is the supervisor in our Hazardous Waste Remediation Bureau. And I've actually asked Jim and maybe Carly, if possible, I don't know if Carly knows it yet, to act as sort of runners with some remote microphones so that as we find people that want to ask questions, we can get a microphone to you so that we can all hear you. What I'd like to do for this question and answer session, and actually I think I want to come down to the floor if I could. Try not to irritate this speaker here. What I'd like to do, and this usually works pretty well, and I think it's the best way to treat everybody. I know a lot of you have questions and concerns. For those who can't stay too late or would really like to just ask a question and be on their way, what I'd like to do is ask anybody who would like to ask a question to limit their comments or their question to about 3 minutes, and then we'll certainly do our very best to answer that question. And then we'll go on to the next person. And then once everybody's had an opportunity who wants to speak once, we'll go through again and we'll stay as long as you like to answer your questions. But I just want to try to do it in such a way that everybody has an opportunity to get a question without necessarily having to stay to the very end. So with that, I guess the best way we can do this is just ask folks to raise your hand if you have a question, and either Jim or Carly will bring a mic to you. Should be a switch.
Using the objective data that you have, could you give us some idea of what your level of concern is as a terms of risk to the human population, in terms of distance from the source? And secondly, as you clean up this site, what will be your measures of success? What are you measuring?
Thank you. Paul, I'm going to ask you to take a crack at that, if you could.
Yeah, the main risk or the main pathway we'd be concerned with would be, you know, to groundwater. Somebody digging into the source, which is off limits. I mean, that's controlled by the college. It would be consumptive use of the water. I mean, to date, we have that one well that has consistently been detected 4.5 to 6 or so micrograms per liter, well above our drinking water standard of 3, hence the treatment system, et cetera. But again, what the investigations do is define the extent of that plume, and then that basically area gets defined, and there's a deed recordation process, so that groundwater essentially becomes off limits for consumptive use. And if the college doesn't acquire the properties or acquire the groundwater rights, they're basically required to provide treatment if a well was drilled within that area in the future. There's those kinds of restrictions to control potential future exposures. I mean, does that get at your question, or am I happy to?
If I may, I think the second part of your question is how do you measure whether you've been successful or not?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, they're required to restore groundwater quality, so it meets the groundwater standard. The formal term under our rules is the ambient groundwater quality standard. And again, the process we go through by focusing on source and then controlling the extent of the plume, if you can implement an effective remedy to take care of that source, then that basically cuts off the feeding of the plume, if you will, the source of the contamination that's creating that plume. And over time, it will restore. It may take a while, but that's the end point, the end game.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Thanks. Skip Jenkins, 7 Fern Lane, Abutter. If all this water is going down into fractured rock, it sounds like there's a lot of concern about soil above that doesn't retain 1,4-dioxane. And how far down into the rock are you actually meaning to protect the water flow out of there? I mean, you can't tell how deep these fractures are. I guess they go forever, right?
Yeah, again, that's in part why they're doing multi-level installations. As Jim mentioned, there's, you know, couplet and triplet installations. And in addition to, you know, we tend to think of things in plan view or map view, and, you know, I wave my arms a lot to talk about enclosing the plume, but that GMZ, they basically need to define a bottom to the system. I don't know if you have an example of the deepest wells perhaps you've put in and if found detected 1,4-dioxane, again, knowing there's ongoing drilling as we speak and you don't have the final picture, but Jim might be able to put a point on it.
Yeah, so the deepest wells that we have at this point are a little over 100 feet. But importantly, those triplets that Paul just mentioned help us understand how the water is moving. We can look at the what we call the hydraulic head or the kind of like the pressure of the water at different depths and determine whether or not it's flowing upward or downward. And as I probably didn't quite clearly say before, in the source area, we have a condition where it's going into rock. When we get to the center of the valley, and this is typical for those sorts of settings, we have a condition where it's coming out of the rock. So we're going to look at the actual flow of it. And while an exact level, we won't know the deepest point it actually ever hits, we do know that within the valley area right now, there is a very, very strong upward gradient. So water is definitely flowing upward. So it's not like it would continue down indefinitely. And also, nor would it continue to the northeast indefinitely, because the large hill that Derry Lane runs along creates this hydraulic head, which kind of creates a barrier to flow towards the northeast and results in it upwelling within the valley. I hope that helps.
Thanks, Jim. And Jim, we had one right here.
Trigelski, Rennie Road. Dr. Kenna, can you tell me, the waste originated in a laboratory that was using radioactive material, and you've mentioned the scintillation fluid. So that had radioactive material plus the 1,4-dioxane. It seems like most of the testing has to do with 1,4-dioxane. Mr. Week mentioned that, like in the green soil, they determined a lack of radioactivity. How do you, can you accurately rule out that radioactivity is in the soil, the remaining soil up there? How do you do that?
The when you do scintillation fluid, when you do the analysis, you're putting very small amounts. The machinery is very sensitive, so you're putting very small amounts in the, of radioactivity actually in the scintillation thing. It counts, and then you do your multiplication to actually find out what the total would actually be. So very small amounts are actually put in there to start with. But all of the analysis we've had at this point says that they do not find any radiation, and they have fairly fairly good measurements of both soil and water, and we haven't found any radiation. A lot of the radiation that they used also was short-term. As you know, there's only like four that were long-term, and we have not found any at this point. So all we can do is just go by the analysis that's given us. So that's what we're basing our results on.
Could you have 1,4-dioxane and not, I'm sorry, could they have no 1,4-dioxane but have radioactivity?
Yes, the radioactivity could have been something else instead of the scintillation fluid. If anything had come off the actual tissues, which were contained in the bags, and very much, as Mr. Watts said, basically were some of them very much intact. So not a lot of the radiation seemed to come out of the bags. And that's what the, when they did their experimentation on the different animals, they used different types and different amounts of radiation. And the animal bodies were then frozen and put in the bags, and then they were taken and buried there, which was the legal way of burying radioactive waste at that time period. So they did that properly. And radiation could have come out of the bags, but from what we've seen, we haven't found any. But as I said, all the red soil, all the material that was cut was actually touching the bags, all of that was shipped off anyway. So any radiation you would think that would have escaped would have been in that red soil. But that was all disposed of off-site. That was taken to a waste site. So that has all been removed. So what they then tested was the soil that we're leaving on-site, which would be outside of that area where the actual material was.
So we're sure that there's no radioactivity?
Basing it on all the analytical results they've done quite a few sampling on the entire site.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question, sir.
Thank you. My name is Peter Spiegel. I live in the area. I want to make sure I have this right, and I think you can correct me if I'm wrong, but 1,4-dioxane was discovered in 2011, at the latest 2012, in the soil while they were searching for radioactivity. It was sort of an inadvertent discovery. And there's been a lot of testing, and I do want to compliment the parties involved in the extensive testing. I mean, that's really quite comprehensive. Although I do have another question as to how far down it goes to capture, do we know what the very tips of the plume is? But to return to the tack that I'm taking, is so now we're some remediation has been done with the ground penetrating, after the ground penetrating radar, some excavation, but I'm trying to understand, and maybe Mr. Rydell can answer this, why nothing was done in this four-year interval. Why would the state allow this contamination to exist and obviously moving and not mandate that there needed to be something incisive done about it?
You're right on the April 2012, that was the first detect in the, that initial network of monitoring wells, GZ1 through 4, GZ2 showed a detect of 1,4-dioxane. And basically, right or wrong, the decision that was made at that point was to continue monitoring and see what happened to that. Was it just a blip? They did confirmatory sampling, I think, 2 weeks later and got a similar number. And if you follow the record, which I'm sure you have, there was a sequence of additional monitoring wells put in basically to follow that once that concentration persisted. And you know, had it been a more typical contaminant, it probably wouldn't have gone as far as fast as it did. But the distance from GZ2 to the downgrading property line was about 500 feet, so they're kind of working within that area to see how far it went. And, you know, with the wisdom of hindsight, maybe we could have gone further faster with monitoring wells, but that was the process that was followed at the time.
So do you typically wait 4 years if you when you discover a contaminant and watch it for that period
again,
of time?
Again, the initial response was quarterly monitoring. We followed that for quite a while. And then when were the first additional wells put in? It wasn't 4 years later. Yeah. Maybe a year and a half.
Well, I mean, I'm not arguing about the discussing the data. You have extensive data. I mean, it's very revealing. It's striking. My question has to do with the remediation. Why would you wait so long to do something incisive to try to get rid of this material? Is this typical the way the state works?
If I could jump in on that, and the initial data, the initial monitoring that was done, and between the April 2012 and I believe it was probably early 2014 when we get additional wells in there, that did show a decreasing concentration trend, and it appeared that it was going to naturally attenuate long before it got off of the property, because of the presence of it within fractured rock and the decreasing concentration trend, it appeared that what is generally referred to as monitored natural attenuation, allowing hydrodispersion within the subsurface, was going to be the most effective way to deal with it. And there wasn't believed to be a likely source there because the soils had been removed during 2011. So it looked like an end of some residual from that remediation that was in the dissolve and would flush through fairly quickly. The additional wells, the different sequences of phases of wells, were initially consistent with that, and it was in the last set that we put in 2015 where we had at one location a very high concentration, and that's at the point where it was clear that there was a potential for it to go off site. But prior to that, the data suggested that they would have stayed on site and been addressed through natural attenuation.
So if the fact that it isn't attenuating and it actually is increased in concentration to at least in one location to 600 micrograms per liter, so sort of to think conversely of what you're saying, would that suggest then that there is something that's recharging that area and to create those extremely high levels of toxin?
No, I don't believe so. The 600 microgram per liter concentrations that I mentioned were likely there when back in 2012. Again, in hindsight, a boring there might have shown us that. We did have this perimeter network, which was showing us the decrease in concentrations, but I believe that material was just residual contamination, which was not removed in 2011. Not necessarily contaminated soil again. That purple soil came out, but this contaminant, because it partitions itself into the groundwater, it was in the residual groundwater. At least that's our understanding right now. We do want to go back and intensively sample the soils in that area to rule out or rule in. If it's there, we want to find it, but to find out whether or not there is an actual source in the sense of something that is going into groundwater. The source that we speak of is really already dissolved in groundwater. So I think that 600 concentration was there before. It doesn't represent an increase. It represents an area that wasn't identified previously.
I have one at least last question for now, and then I'll cease. But I've been here 50 years, and this is the driest summer that I can remember, at least the latter two-thirds of it. And I wondered if this presents some anomalies, slowing down the passage of these plumes, or presents you with any unique opportunities to take advantage of this sort of quiescent recharging of subsurface water.
I think one opportunity it provides us with is to go in there and do that intensive soil sampling to find out, you know, if there is residual source in the sense of a soil soil contamination that we need to excavate. I wouldn't recommend that we go forward right now and excavate anything in there that we find until we have that hydraulic control system in place. The pump and treat system that we're talking about has the capability, you know, as I showed in that illustration, to reach out well beyond the area of any potential contaminated soil if it's there. So we can, by moving in with that first, we can extend our reach further to prevent more contamination from leaving the site than we could if we went in and put our priority in excavating soil. I do think with the water level low, it's a great opportunity to collect those data, because normally we would have the problem of groundwater being present in the samples that we remove for soil sampling. We won't have as much of that. There's still some residual water, but it would give us a much better indication. We are, even though right now it's dry, we're still concerned with the potential for creating a more permeable pathway to the bedrock than we already have, that would potentially mobilize more of the 1,4-dioxane out of that source area where the soils somewhat contain it. Not completely at all, but it retains more of it than it would potentially if we dug down to rock, made everything loosened again, increased the permeability, and then had a large storm event or series of them come through. We want to be protected by having that treatment system in place. So I think really the main opportunity is the sampling.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Ellen Waitskin, and I live across the street from Rennie Farm. So continuing the discussion of residual contamination, both chemical and radiological at the site, I understand that it's true that there is a well GZ14 that was showing consistent levels of around 600 micrograms per liter of 1,4-dioxane only this last spring, not in 2012, but 2016, 3 months in a row, February, March, and April. No sampling was done in May. And by the time additional sampling was considered, late in July, that well was dry. And it wasn't until the time, interim time between March and the middle of the summer, that there was an additional requirement to restart measurement of radioactive isotopes. So that well, which consistently gave very high levels of 1,4-dioxane of 600 all spring, could never be sampled for radioactivity. And five other significant wells, which had represented hot spots on the site, were dry, reported as dry this summer. So I just wanted you to comment on the fact that, understanding that an absence of data does not convert to negative data. In other words, the fact that those wells couldn't be sampled doesn't mean that they don't, in fact, have radioactivity inherent in them. They just couldn't be sampled because of the drought. So how do you factor that into your future plans, understanding that those wells are still possible sources of radioactivity and other contaminants that have been initially deposited at the historic dump site?
Thank you. I know Paul and Twyla, I don't know if you want to team up on that.
I mean, I could talk about the groundwater and chime in.
At its heart, I think it's a hydrogeological question.
Keep in mind, we sampled where we could for the radioactivity. We sampled the next highest 1,4-dioxane well at the time, and in our recommendation, our letter, we had listed 14U as because of the 550 to 600. But yeah, I mean, it's a field condition. The well, you're right, the well was dry when it went out to do that sampling. So having the plume, you know,
general direction mapped out, the main axis, if you will. They basically went to the next available well, which also had, what was the well? Was it 9L? Just to put a point on it. You know, concentrations of 1,4-dioxane at 9L, which was sampled for the radionuclides in replace of 14U being dry, 1,4-dioxane concentrations at 9L had ranged from a low of 77 up to a high of 520. And again, it's further down gradient from the source area, hence it's a little bit lower than 14U. And then he also sampled other wells in the area just to get a database on the radionuclides. So again, I take your point. I mean, it's something we'd be happy to consider going forward. If, you know, we see similar concentrations within the source area, you know, we may consider sampling again for radionuclides at those, you know, one or more locations.
Yes, I would just hope that you would hold and reserve your final judgment about those areas that you couldn't sample because they were very high in the spring. And they're, you know, based on the way the deposits were made in the first place, in addition to the further disorganization of the contaminant materials during various excavations, there probably is a fair amount of inhomogeneity in that field, so that one particular site being sampled may not be equivalent to something a few feet over. So it's going to take, I think, very fastidious sampling to really characterize what's going on there, because clearly there is a plume, it's growing, it's extending out into a neighborhood, it's been tracked quite a far way down a free-flowing surface stream. It's very alarming how much farther all of this contamination is now being seen to spread. And there's a lot of reason to be very concerned about source material now, not only residual source area at the site itself, but the formation of new source area as the contaminants propagate themselves through the soils from surface to deep, in properties that may lie outside the boundaries of what Dartmouth property owns. And, you know, in that eventuality, how would you plan to extend your remediation beyond Dartmouth property lines?
You know, again, I would fall back on what we've tried to explain tonight and, you know, what I've tried to explain to you in our prior conversations. The plume is fairly well mapped out. They put forth a strategy for the RAP, which is the most recent document that's been submitted. You know, it's currently under review in large measure. That's why the meeting tonight is scheduled when it is, because it's, you know, we're actively reviewing that report. We wanted to get concerns and your input as part of that review process. You can go through that report, and they're at the point where we're starting to get enough data now that we can actually look at trends and individual monitoring points. And if you think in terms of, again, that extent of the plume, we're close to the point of having that fairly well bounded on that main transport direction off to the northeast, and also having three-dimensionally the hydraulics of groundwater flow pretty well figured out, and it's probably going to be discharging to that stream, and that may very well be about as far as the plume goes and about as far as the GMZ needs to be defined.
So you consider the private well that is known to be contaminated to be part of the plume?
Yes.
And has that been measured for radioactivity?
No. Again, what we did was sample the wells that were higher in 1,4-dioxane for radioactivity.
Thank you.
Thank you. And
my name is Sarah, and I'd just like to follow up on what Ellen and Peter have said. That private well, 1,4-dioxane, has been found, and it hasn't been tested for radionuclides. Tritium was found on the site up above, and tritium would make it through the carbon filter that's been put in that point entry system. Well, and the Higgins are still showering in this, and so I think that it would seem to me that testing their well for these radionuclides would become a priority, and I asked these questions in May, and I was told it was not from you, but I would think that would become a priority. I also think that Jim Weeks has done his job in that letter in June of 2014, in June 14th of 2012, he notified the state that there was high amounts of 1,4-dioxane found in GZ2. He also, in the end of that letter, pointed out to the state and to Dartmouth College that was CC'd on that letter that there were residential wells nearby, and the state nor Dartmouth College notified anyone in connection with those residential wells. So I don't see that as a problem of Jim or Charles doing their job. I see that as a real disconnect in terms of the state and in terms of Dartmouth College. And I would think that the comments about being neighborly moving forward extend to that we got to protect people. People need to be protected, and you need to get ahead of the plume.
I want to thank you for that comment. And I do want to say something that hasn't been said yet by any of the other speakers, and that is that I think it was mentioned earlier that our primary purpose for having a program for investigating and cleaning up contaminated sites is to make sure that people don't get exposed to contaminants. That's why we have a program. And, you know, a lot of times site investigations take time. There's a lot of iterations, as you've heard tonight. But in the end, if we end up going and asking a responsible party or doing it ourselves to go sample private drinking water wells, we're in all cases doing that as a precaution. We don't ever want to find it. We don't expect to find it most of the time. And in this case, we did find the presence of 1,4-dioxane in a well, in a private drinking water well that was above the ambient groundwater quality standard. And that's always a huge disappointment. And we always immediately wish we had done that sooner. And we didn't require it to be done sooner, and we should have. And I can't walk that back. I can't change that timeline. But I can only tell you that whenever we find a well that's contaminated, a drinking water well where someone's using the water that's above ambient groundwater quality standards, that's a huge disappointment. And we always wish we'd done it sooner. And we certainly wish we'd done that sooner in this case. As I said, we can't walk that back. But what we can do is make sure that we do this, continue to conduct this investigation and clean up as thoroughly as possible. And that's what we intend to do here. And as you've heard earlier tonight, that will include long-term monitoring of the drinking water wells in the area to make sure that the remedy that's developed here and implemented continues to be protective.
And if I could, I mean, there was two or three questions there, and I'll try to answer them in order, at least for the groundwater aspects of it. But I'd like to get your thoughts on the tritium question, because that's not my field. Again, the 1,4-dioxane being sourced from the site, most likely scintillation fluid, part of that cocktail. The radionuclides had not been detected in the prior groundwater monitoring that was done at the site pre and post excavation, that initial monitoring well network. The confirmatory sampling, in my view, was, again, if there had been water in 14U, we would have sampled that for radionuclides being the highest detected concentration of 1,4-dioxane. The next best was 9L. The radionuclides were not detected in that well when it was sampled for radionuclides. I don't see the connection where something could get by those wells. If the radionuclides are not present in a well that's had 77 to 550 micrograms per liter 1,4-dioxane, I don't see the connection with it getting to a drinking water well that has the 1,4-dioxane concentration about 6, just looking at mass and where the 1,4-dioxane is. I mean, does that make sense? And then the other question, there was another groundwater aspect to that I think I've forgotten. No?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the other question might have been, but I think what we'd like to do is take your concern and your consideration here, under consideration, and think about that, and think about whether it makes sense to, as a precaution, do that anyways. So I appreciate your concern. We have another woman who has a question here.
Sandra Miller, I have just an incidental note. I had a close friend, Tess Kelso, who had graduated from Dartmouth in the first graduating class with Head Women, and she was a teaching assistant at the grade school in Hanover, and she lived on the Rennie farm. And she took me out one day to see this big circle on the edge of a field. And I can't remember very well. I think it was about 15 feet in diameter and had nothing growing in it. It was absolutely barren. And there was no way, she was just so curious what that could have been, you know, finally figuring it out. But she just died in June of pancreatic cancer, so she'll never know the... She does know that this investigation is going on, but she did know. But that's a, it would be interesting also to know about other people who lived in the area historically to see what happened in the 70s and 80s.
Thank you. I just want to give, if there's anyone else, then we'll come back to you. Anyone else have a question?
I have a question on his comment before it gets lost.
Okay. Jim, you want to give me?
I'll just speak louder. Wouldn't it be prudent to, we know this is a crushing toxin, we know that it's been in the area, would it be prudent to do an epidemiologic survey of the people who live in the rainforest?
In case there was surface contamination, which might not be present now. I don't know whether that well still exists, but I have a sense that it does. And but it might have been diluted out, but it, those people might have been exposed. And, you know, there's a, what was that book called, Civil Action, about a leukemia cluster in Woburn, Mass. Well, let's hope that isn't the case, but, you know, it would be important to trace the health of that population that lived there for whatever it was, a decade, to, and these are Dartmouth grads, it wouldn't matter who they were, I mean, they're human beings, but I would think that Dartmouth would want to find out what has happened with these individuals.
Go ahead.
Hi, Peter. I just wanted to let you know that Dartmouth is in the process of trying to contact former neighbors that surround Rennie Farm from the 60s onward.
And the people that live down
here. Yes, yes. Okay.
And nearby as well?
Yes, we're trying to figure out the parameters that we're going to be using for the notification. Okay, thank you.
Which, as I understand, has never yet been tested.
We have, actually.
And so you're going to go ahead and test that well?
Right. There's some issues in getting into the well right now that I think we're working with GZA to overcome, because it's dangerous to go inside of this space without certain safeguards, because it could actually collapse on the person who's doing actually the sampling. So we've been working on that since the summer to try to get that. Or Jim, you want to talk about that?
Yes, Maureen is correct. There may have been multiple wells. I don't know, but we did find earlier this year a structure that has a well in it. There is no power to it, and Maureen has indicated, we consider it a confined space, and there are a number of precautions that we need to take before we can get in there and bring power to the pump and sample from it. We're in the process of doing that. I would also say too that we did install last winter a water supply well in the vicinity of that abandoned well. And we did sample that at discrete levels within the well, at locations where we encountered fractures that water might be moving along for the 1,4-dioxane, and did not detect anything there. And that general area where the old farmhouse at the entrance to the site was located is not in the area that we understand 1,4-dioxane to be moving, so it's not within the plume area. Not to discount the value of doing the things that have been suggested, but just to put it in the correct perspective so people understand where that well is located, that it is not in an area that we believe to be impacted by 1,4-dioxane. And we do have samples from right nearby where the old well is, but we will sample that once we can.
Thanks. We have one over there.
Farm, which I gather was very close to the She was being trodden down for the people who had subsequently lived on that farm and had major health problems. She herself and her husband had problems when they were living there, and they were concerned about being a possible whistleblower. They were afraid to bring it, to the attention of the public, because they were also looking at the farm as a subsequent source of that contaminated water. And she has even retained a filter from that period, which she hopes to get tested at some point to see what kind of contaminants were found in there. She also has been tracking some of these names and has provided me with a list of phone numbers and addresses and whereabouts, which I would be very happy to supply to the college in further investigation. Could you repeat that last?
You want me to repeat? Yeah, just to recap as best I heard it, she's from. Do you want to speak again? If you hold the mic a little closer to your face.
Okay. I can provide a list from this former postdoc who had lived on the Stibitz farm, and she herself has been doing an investigation because she had major health issues, and she also had a fetus that was deformed that she was very concerned about. And she had always thought that it was the water supply from that source. She retained a water filter, and she is going to independently have that tested now that she is much more aware of what has been going on with the remediation project and Rennie Farm. I can supply the college with a list of these names if you would like to have them.
Yes, actually, I was.
And there are lots of phone numbers and addresses and whereabouts of, all the people that had lived subsequently on the Stibitz farm. Now, she had tried to contact the daughter of George Stibitz, but she said that they hung up on her. They didn't really want to get into the discussion. Okay. I think many people were fearful that if they raised issues and if they had connections to the college, that it wouldn't look good. They were often afraid for their employment. And I don't know whether the husband of the daughter is still working for the medical center, but certainly they were on the faculty at Dartmouth College. And that makes it much more problematic.
I would really love it.
I think Peter has been fantastic in being much more open. He is the only person that I have discovered who's been willing to speak publicly about this.
So I would be really grateful if you send me that list.
Also,
for everybody in the audience,
if
you do know previous neighbors, I'd really be grateful if I could get a list of their names or contact information or whatever you have, so we can reach out to them.
She has made a spreadsheet, so I could supply you with
that
spreadsheet.
That's great. Thank
you. I have one other question, and it was about the water sampling. Were any other organic chemicals, volatile organic chemicals, tested other than 1,4-dioxane? And I was thinking that in scintillation fluids back in the 60s and 70s, they were using other substances other than dioxane. They were using benzene and others.
Thank you. Paul, do you want to talk?
And again, Jim can probably chime in with more details, but there was quite a lot of testing done. A number of locations for the full, what we would call the full list of volatile organic compounds, and that's the EPA method 8260. And there's about, if memory serves, I think about 60 or 65 compounds that are reported by the laboratories running that method. And it includes all the common petroleum compounds, benzene, toluene, gasoline constituents, as well as the common solvents, PCE, et cetera. once we've established the 1,4-dioxane was the primary contaminant, that has really been the focus. And so the majority of samples have only been analyzed for that. But even with the latest round of additional source characterization, additional monitoring wells, they've selected a number of locations and have gone back and run the full 8260, and really haven't found anything of additional concern relative to the groundwater standards. I mean, I don't know if there's an embellishment needed there, but I'll defer to you.
Thanks, Paul.
I just wanted to mention that apropos of Peter's idea for epidemiological study and the data that she has as well, and I understand you're willing to reach out privately to try to contact people within a certain parameter, would you be willing to even go so far as to take out an ad in the Valley News saying, within this geographical parameter, we're interested in anybody who'd like to talk to us who lived in this area from this date to this date? So that you're not just contacting people privately, but institutional knowledge, town knowledge goes way, way, way back. I just think you'd have a lot of people come forward that you might not be able to just contact privately.
Sounds like a great idea. I'll be in touch with our communications person to figure out how to best get that accomplished, but I think it's a great idea. Thank you.
Thank you. Another question in the second row here.
Hello. My name is Duncan Syme. I live at 52 Rennie, and which is at the bottom of the hill. And so I'm sure people will think we're okay, but we're not okay. Our well is 62 inches deep. There's currently 30 inches of water in that well, which is essentially the level of Hughes Brook. So what that means is whatever comes into the surface water and flows into the south branch of Hughes Brook is eventually going to come to our house. Eventually. I have no idea whether it's going to be 2 years, 10 years, 50 years, what's in the cracks of the rock. We're 400 or 500 feet below this site. That is going to come to the surface. It's going to get into Hughes Brook. Now, it may be way diluted beyond any measure of importance, but I'm concerned about a couple of things. But before I kind of get into that, I was confused about one thing that Jim did. I wonder if you could clarify it for me. There was a slide which showed the affected excavation area, and then there were a bunch of blue rectangles which you said represented historical potential burial sites. And I'm wondering, were those explored? Have they all been explored?
This actually might be a better question for Charles to address, because that was really the focus of the work in 2011.
Yes, sir. So what that image was attempting to show you was we had a hand-drawn map that showed the 43 distinct burials that I was referencing when I was giving my presentation. That map Jim had overlaid onto a geological map of the site. So we went through those entire areas looking for waste, and that's the source where we got the animal waste, the laboratory waste, and the red soil that we had shipped off-site for disposal. So all of those have been investigated.
Okay, so there wasn't really anything in those blue areas. It was all in that other one spot.
That's where the blue areas
are. Oh, the blue areas are within that excavator.
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
I understand
so,
now.
So there
I understand.
Was, there was the burial area, okay. And within the area there were 43 okay. plots. We investigated the entire burial area, inclusive of those 43 plots.
Okay. I guess my concern... I think you guys have done an incredible job. I am a little concerned that 2011, you know, a private well was discovered to be contaminated. Those people were not notified, even immediately following your disclosure. I guess what I'm mostly concerned about is with Dartmouth's reaction to this whole thing. I think that your gathering has been good. I am wondering, when is this sort of barrier pumping treatment facility going to be online? Do we have a date for that?
We're doing our best to get that started operating by the end of the year.
Okay.
We do need to have approvals from the Department of Environmental Services. They need to do their work, which is reviewing ours and providing comment on that. In the meanwhile, we are still moving ahead on some basic things, bringing utilities out there that we need to, and getting that working. There are a lot of steps in it, so we're moving as quickly as we can on that, and that's our target date.
Okay, right, but now the target is the first of the year.
That's right. That's our target.
Okay, but I guess my concern, one of my concerns is, I continue to get letters that say that 1,4-dioxane appears in paint strippers and cosmetics or whatever. This is insulting to us. Please do not do that. It is not productive. In fact, it's so counterproductive that it really is giving Dartmouth a bad eye, because what it says is we're trying to protect ourselves. We Dartmouth here are, we're kind of like Love Canal, and we don't want any information to get out. And, oh, by the way, this stuff isn't really that bad anyway. That really is insulting, Maureen. I don't want you to respond, please.
Okay.
I just want you to be aware of that issue. But the other thing I'm concerned about is, as I said, eventually this plume is going to get to my property. Whether it's of health importance or not is not going to matter. When I go to sell my house, my property is now worth less. Everybody's property on Rennie's Road is now worth less. In some cases, the depreciation has been 100%. But in any case, for everybody, it's some. And I want to know, what is Dartmouth going to do about that? How about, for example, going to the town and having our houses reappraised at a lower value so our taxes go down? In the case of a guy who's property is almost worthless. Is he continuing to pay taxes on that property, or is Dartmouth paying them? What is the ultimate responsibility here? When I go to sell my house, if I lose 10% on it, is Dartmouth going to pony up another 1.1% on top of my sale price to make me whole because of the situation that they promulgated? I think that these are morality issues. This was the kind of thing that was talked about earlier in terms of making good neighbors. And it goes beyond, just doing the right thing. There's a moral issue here, which I think that Dartmouth really needs to address. And I know that has nothing to do with the DES and you guys that are doing a commendable job on the work that you're doing. We may have questions. We may think the timeline isn't fast enough and so on. But I think you're doing your best. I think Dartmouth, however, needs to get on top of the moral issue, because as we know, if this thing goes viral, Dartmouth is in the education business. They're telling their students, maybe you can cover it up. That's our impression. Maybe we can drag our feet a little. Maybe we can, put out public relations meetings and things like that. But what they're educating the kids in is not a sense of morality here. And I think that has to be the vision that's driving Dartmouth's solution to this whole thing. So I don't need a response to that. I just wanted to say my piece about that. Thank you.
Thank you. Another question?
Okay, my question is, you're sampling wells that you've dug, 36 or so of them. Are they sampled monthly?
Paul, do you want to talk about that, or do you want to handle on the direction
of groundwater flow? Some of these wells are ones where we haven't detected 1,4-dioxane, and we sample those at a different frequency. There aren't any wells out there that have been installed and abandoned, but we adjust our sampling frequency based on the sum of our understanding of the site. So we don't just handle it. Every well doesn't get sampled every month. That really isn't where we want to be focusing our energy. We want to be focusing it on sampling, you know, in the higher priority areas and expanding our network. I hope that helps.
Thank you. Another question. One down front here, and then it's Waitskin. We'll get you next. I'm sorry.
I'm Marjorie Rogelsky. I was the one that signed the letter with the other 36 supporting signatures to ask for a public meeting, among other things. And I'm very glad the DES agreed to come. I was disappointed that they picked a Dartmouth venue to hold the meeting. And I called Mr. Wimsett. He has assured me that any future meetings would be held at a neutral site, such as the Black Community Center or possibly one of the schools. And part of the reason I was upset about having it on this venue was it was Dartmouth property, and unfortunately, the young lady that I had arranged to videotape the recording tonight, she's with CATV, she was going to record the meeting, and it would have been posted on their website so that all the people who couldn't attend, or anyone who wanted to review the you know, there's lots of material here. Unfortunately, Dartmouth did not allow that young lady to come in tonight. So going forward, I believe Mr. Burak and Mr. Wimsett had said that going forward we'll be on a public venue, not a private property. And CATV has assured us that they will be there when they can. Now I have a question. And this is about the technical kind of treatment. So we have two situations. We have a situation where you want to pump and treat the 1 foot axane. And my first question is, how effective have been pump and treatment systems been in the past for this particular contaminant? And then you have the other situation where you've already had the contaminant in a private well. That's a point of entry system.
Right.
How effective are they in removing the 1 foot axane?
There's a very good track record with the technology they're proposing to use for the pump and treat up at the site. You know, it's a what have we been calling it process, the Steve Woodard microbead, you know, it's been used in a number of places, typically I think on some fairly large municipal well high flow rate systems, and it's emerging as a proven technology for 1,4 dioxane, which can be difficult to treat. There's really two main aspects of the proposed pump and treat. There's the pure treatment technology we're talking about, stripping or removing the 1,4 dioxane from the water. I think this technology is very, very promising. It's been proven in a number of instances. There's always confirmation testing when the thing's actually built and implemented to make sure it's working as designed. The other major aspect is just hydraulic controls. Are the wells close enough? Do we know enough about the permeability of the bedrock, et cetera, that they're going to be pumping, so that we can hydraulically control as they anticipate? And the design really is pretty conservative in that regard, is our sense. There's sufficient wells there to hydraulically influence the area they need to. But again, that will all be confirmed through water level measurements, et cetera, as this thing is built and implemented. And it was another shade of a question, too, I think. To do... Yeah, do you have an estimate in the wrap? I mean, again, you build it, you put it in, and we monitor performance as we're going along. So as we collect that data, you're able to extrapolate from there and get a much better real-world estimate. So anything they provide now is sort of, you know, a guesstimate without having the system in place.
Yeah, I think Paul's really just covered it. Now, we did use a number of 5 years in the wrap. That's in part driven by the groundwater management permit process, which typically runs on a five-year basis, so we tend to think in those increments. We're hopeful that we're going to see success, significant success long before then, but as Paul said, we really do need to get it in place first to understand how it's going to work.
And I don't know if that's sufficient, but I think you also had the point of entry treatment system. That's very effective. What it is two carbon canisters, granular activated carbon, basically in series. So what we'd call the effluent, the untreated groundwater, goes into the first container, the first vessel, and passes through there and then goes into the second one. And so the performance monitoring that they do is effluent upgrading upstream of the first vessel in between the two and then downstream of the second, which is the treated influent. And to date, 1,4-dioxane hasn't been detected in the influent. Where we've had issues over the years with granular activated carbon and 1,4-dioxane treatment typically seems to be when there's other stuff involved. So if you have benzene or some other contaminants and you also have 1,4-dioxane, the other contaminants tend to get treated a little more effectively by the granular activated carbon and sometimes not as effectively but for the 1,4-dioxane. But here, where that's all we're really trying, the only contaminant present, it's, again, performance monitoring has demonstrated that it's been working pretty well.
Thanks, Paul. And if I could just expand on a couple of those things. One is I do want to, in terms of just, and this is in the abstract, not for the Rennie Farm site, but any site where we implement a pump and treat system as part of the remedy, that is a long-term commitment in many cases. It's just the technical feasibility of pulling all the affected groundwater out of the ground, treating it, and removing it, is a really tall order. And so, you know, I think we've heard what, you know, GZA's estimates are, how fast it can be effective, but I do want to make sure people understand this is not a situation where you go in 6 months you pump a lot of groundwater and then the site's clean. We wish that were true. We wish we could remediate sites that way, but most of the time we can't. But what we can do is manage the contamination. In some cases, we can very effectively remove the contaminants in a relatively short period of time, but not always. So that will be a work in progress as time advances here. The second thing I want to expand on is your comment about the cable access television, and I want to apologize for that. I had not realized, but apparently the cable access television folks had showed up about a half hour before the meeting tonight, and they were denied entry. I didn't know that till the last minute. We spoke with the college, and they made arrangements to allow them to come. And unfortunately, Ms. Rogalski was not able to contact that person and get them back here, so they weren't able. So they, just to be clear, they were denied access at first. There was a decision made that they could come back, but unfortunately, they weren't able to make it back. And Ms. Rogalski is absolutely right. In future, if we have public meetings in the future with respect to this site, we will have them at probably a town location, so it will be off the Dartmouth College campus.
Thank you, because that was one of my first three comments that I was going to address, because Assistant Commissioner Wimsatt, you and I spoke on the phone last week about exactly this issue, and I told you that we already had arranged to have the entire auditorium at Hanover High School available to us with audiovisual equipment, and you resisted and insisted that it be here. And I told you that violation of freedom of the press, freedom of speech, and freedom of the public was the most dear value in our group, and you assured me that if there was any issue, you would take care of it. And I told you that was one of the reasons we did not want the meeting to be held here. So while I'm glad that in arrears, you did attempt to allow cable TV to come in here, I'm very disappointed that there was any resistance to allowing them to come in the first place. Because we had a long discussion. I actually called Commissioner Burek about this initially, and you returned my call in his stead. So for the record, I do expect that there will be many more public meetings about this project. This is not going to be resolved overnight, and I do expect that our neighborhood and the public should be able to interact with the state agencies and also the people doing the work on the site so that we have some input and also maintain transparency of information. While posting things on websites is wonderful, it can be very confusing to wade through the data, and I think having a chance to have this sort of exchange is very important, so that I hope that there is a full commitment on the part of the state and people involved in the excavation to continue to hold many sequential public meetings about this in the future.
We're certainly prepared to come back when needed. We will commit to doing that. And I do want to just as I think we discussed, and I discussed with Ms. Rogalski a week or so ago, we were very concerned that this happens to be the evening of the primary election in New Hampshire. The high school was being utilized as a polling place, and we didn't want this meeting in any way to interfere with that, and that was the reason that we elected not to go there. We didn't realize when we actually scheduled the meeting that it coincided with the primary election. If we could have, we probably would have picked this another night. But in future, we will stay away from election night, and we will plan to have them at a public, a town-owned facility. So we'll
great. And then my other two very brief comments as a physician, and I think Dr. Spiegel will agree with me that while there may be some categorization in the DES documents that distinguishes inhalation from ingestion, from a physician's point of view and from a biological point of view, inhalation is ingestion. And anybody breathing vapors in a shower, for instance, is ingesting through their lungs and through their lung tissues vapors. And so it's just as the same as drinking it. And you can just look as an example at what happens with cigarette smokers getting lung cancer. You are ingesting what you inhale, just for the record, from a medical point of view. And I guess that will cover my comments for the evening.
Thank you. Another question?
Thank you. My name is Bill Tingle, and we live at 44 Rennie Road. And certainly the health issue is number one, and that's what we're mostly addressing. And everybody has had great comments. And I'm very much impressed by the work the team is doing to understand and try to control nature's very unpredictable processes and the knowledge they all have. But I still do want to follow up on Duncan's point about the property value, if I may. And I'm concerned about that issue as well. And how do we formally bring that to the agenda? Is the burden on the residents, or will Dartmouth follow the good neighbor policy and present something to us to review and discuss? And maybe there's even precedent for that issue within the state of New Hampshire and other places that could be examined. Again, the health issue is number one, but I think we should be clear and understand that whole situation as well and what we should do about it. Thank you. If there's a comment about that and how we proceed, it would be, I think, interesting for the audience.
Thank you. I don't have a direct answer for how we do it, but I completely agree with the comment that Dartmouth needs to find a way to address this. I don't know what the right answer is, but I commit to you as the executive vice president that it's been raised, I'm aware of it, it makes complete sense to me, and we'll work on thinking through what process makes sense. Whether it's okay with everybody, a longer-term issue, but I think the point is well taken, and here we'll deal with it. Thank you.
Next question.
My name is Don Corey. I lived at 8 Rennie Road across from 9 Rennie Road for 3 or 4 years. And I'm here to speak briefly about the morality issue on Dartmouth's part. I am sorely disappointed. A fellow succeeded me at 8 Rennie Road and lived there for another 3 years or so. This was while the contamination of the property was occurring. We were all in the area then generally aware of it. But he went to the office of the president of the college, John Kemeny, buttonholed him and said, Mr. Kemeny, or Dr. Kemeny, why are you letting the college do this? And he said, I was personally unaware of that. I'm horrified. It will stop tomorrow. It continued for several years. That's one point. The second point is my profound disappointment in the college in keeping the cable antenna TV people off there tonight. That's outrageous. Thank you.
Thank you. Another question. You still have the mic. That's pretty good.
Yes.
I have one technical question first. Is there going to be on-site generation for this pumping plant?
Power generation?
Will there be standby generation?
There wouldn't be standby generation.
There would not?
That would operate the plant, no.
Okay, then that leads to my second thing, which is this thing about this the cable TV. Young kids these days don't stand for immorality at higher levels. I mean, you know, we see it in this whole electoral process going on. You know, both candidates have the highest negativity comments, ratings that any candidates have ever had. These kids, if somehow a greater population of the Dartmouth kids thinks that Dartmouth has been misbehaving in this manner, a couple of things are going to happen. One is they're going to question why they're paying an exorbitant amount of money to come to a school which isn't behaving properly. And number the next is, you know, something, maybe instead of giving my millions now that I've gotten to be an important person later on in life to Dartmouth, maybe I'll just give it to my boarding school instead. You know, there are all kinds of ramifications here that really, I think, have to be taken into account. And I think this notion about, you know, property values, Bill is right. And I think that the way for Dartmouth to respond is to suggest having a meeting, you know, very soon, and to start talking and opening up some avenues of potential, you know, progress or whatever, but not just sweeping it under the rug like what happened to me when I talked to Maureen a year ago was, would you like your well tested? We'll have that done. We'll send a guy over. We'll have somebody kind of nothing, absolutely nothing. So, guys, you have to act, and you have to get ahead of this thing, because if you're already behind the power curve. And, you know, if it goes viral, it's you're toast.
Thank you. Another question. Yes, sir.
Do I have it? Yes. So recently, the contamination was found in a tributary that feeds into Hughes Brook. Now, the contamination by standards, or at least by comparison to that higher up on the burial site, is very small. But we don't know where that's going to go. And marine life has a way, I mean, I'm not in biologist, but I do know from what we just read in the newspapers that marine life has a way of concentrating toxins and kind of moves up the food chain. Now, years ago, or even though I let my trout go now, years ago I used to fish Hughes Brook with my children, my sons, and we keep the fish occasionally and we'd eat them. And I suspect there are others who do that today. And so my question is, what does the state, or what procedures does the state follow when a recognized contaminant is in a feeder brook to alert the fishermen and other people who might use Hughes Brook for whatever purposes that there's a potential issue here?
Paul, I don't know. We have obviously very little data at this point. We have one data point here. But Paul, are you aware of any surface water quality standards or biota standards associated with
Dartmouth? No, I don't know where that is as far as development. I mean, to just give you the straightest short answer, and then I think there's probably more to come. We have surface water quality regulations, and they'll address both, you know, marine and freshwater water and fish ingestion, and then protection of aquatic life. But unfortunately, there's not a number for 1,4-dioxane yet. The numbers we have are the direct consumptive risk, the 3 micrograms per liter, parts per billion, and then the 230 that was on the slide earlier for thermal contact.
Well, I'd just comment that here's an opportunity to take some initiative and at least alert fishermen and the public that this is a, and I did use the word, potential problem.
Right.
Right, and I just wanted to weigh in on that a little bit. I've been doing a little bit more research and reading on bioaccumulation of 1,4-dioxane. I don't believe it bioaccumulates in either plant material or aquatic material, and we can certainly look into that a little bit more for you. Plant or like the trees or the aquatic life, it's not known to bioaccumulate, and even when we get in when we get in our systems, there's half-lives for that that are pretty rapid. But that's something we can look into a little bit further.
How about
we're not the marine specialists, but certainly we can try to find more information on that.
And how about the insect life?
I don't know about that.
Okay, because that's what the trout eat, are the insects right. that propagate on the
right.
bottom
but
it, of
but it. It's not known to bioaccumulate in fish. But we will, again, we'll try to get more information on that for you. But if we do find a contaminant that is known to bioaccumulate in fish, we do put out advisories about fishing in areas, and that is something we committed to doing.
Excellent. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Diana Munson. My dad lives at the corner of First and Road across from the Stibbetts house. I lived at the Rennie Farm for a year and a half or 2 years. Somebody mentioned there were coaches who lived there. I was living with biology grad students and associate professor of biology. So I can give a few names for people who live there. Myself, Tom and Tracy Sherry, Michelle Dion, who got cancer in her 30s, probably not related, but she lived there. And another fellow named Rich, he's another graduate student, I could dredge his name up. But these were all Dartmouth people living at the Rennie Farm. And I'm a Dartmouth grad, so we were tied to the college, but we lived there at the Rennie Farm.
Sure, well, I think, and as Maureen has said, she'd appreciate getting all that information from you. Thank you. Another question? Questions or comments or anything? I don't want to close the meeting too early if somebody's sitting on something they want to say or ask. All right, well, seeing none, I want to thank all of you for coming out here this evening. It's not always an easy thing to do. We have been very appreciative of all of you coming out and sharing your concerns, asking your questions, and certainly those of you who have taken the time to write to us or send us an email or call us. We do appreciate that. Everything you have to say and ask us about is important.